It is a way that people have learned to get close.
But it looks so strange from the outside that these people are at each other's throats. You know, how can they be close? Why don't they all just leave?
But they need the closeness, but the closeness is fostered by their hostility. They'll still want the closeness. You know, the old feuding Hatfield and McCoy, and they needed each other. Or, you know, Laurel and Hardy need the cops, and the cops need Laurel and Hardy. Each serves a function for the other. They're complementary functions.
Again, those people then in other circumstances learn to live without that, or will they carry that family quote-unquote?
Who are the other people?
Well, there's a family here, and then the kids get married to somebody else, and they get out of that environment, but do they very easily then carry this tradition?
They may set up the same type of system with another set of people. Unless there's an intervention from the outside. There's a principle of family systems thinking that I didn't mention today. It's called homeostasis. And it simply means that all groups or organizations want coherency and stability. All groups are conservative. I have a cartoon at home that after I gave one of these presentations, a person sent it to me. And it's a bulldozer, not a bulldozer, one of these cranes with a wrecking ball on it. And it's about ready to hit the house. And you see the ball going towards the house. And then the next picture, it's the crane falling to pieces. That's the homeostatic balance of a home or a family. And if you don't believe in homeostasis, introduce a new hymnal next Sunday at church. Systems want to repeat what is familiar. And so in many cases, this is familiar, and this is the way we live, this is the way we do it. There's not even a recognition of what's happening. The hand, other hand. Yes?
I'm just wondering, it seems in the world of counseling, when someone has recommended out that I notice family systems, and so much of this from pastoral point of view, but I don't always pick that up from, you know, just your good psychologist. Is that a true, you know, that's my observation or question anyway. What can you say about that as far as really being in, you know, keying in on some of these insights and being able to use them? Is it primarily in the pastoral counseling, you know, the real tough, you know, like you people, or is the whole psychological community aware of them and using them?
Well, those who are trained in a psychoanalytic model, those who are trained in the psychodynamic model or the behaviorist model still tend to remain denominationalist in their sense, still stay that way. Family systems is often critiqued because there's not a solid base of research yet, because it's only 30 years old. But it's gaining tremendous ascendancy and popularity. It just makes sense to people. It actually started in the treatment of eating disorders and also with drinking disorders. If you've read Frederick Buechner's new book, Telling Secrets, he talks about his daughter's anorexia nervosa. In fact, this corresponds to what I was talking about today. And he said, when you starve yourself, you become so emaciated that your body looks like a child's. But at the same time, by starving yourself, nobody can tell you what to eat or to do what you want, so you remain independent. And Buechner makes the point that, you know, you can nearly kill yourself, that to meet these two needs are so important. And what we're saying is eating disorders, drinking disorders belong in the system, not in someone's psyche. It's not just because someone is intrapsychically incontinent. It's a systemic problem. Why do you need someone with an eating disorder? Why is this person hypnotizing the anxiety in the system? That's what a system thinker, therapist would look at. Not all counselors are using this. No. Wrong way to answer that.
Does a lot of this family system study come from the studies on codependency that have been around, or is it the other way around?
The other way around. Family systems has been around longer than a lot of the codependency literature and so forth that's been out right now. But it also, people use family systems to deal with those and those issues.
Good question. If you could just say a few words on what are some interventions, examples of that, and also what is the healthy family? What's the healthy system?
Well, the last one will take 3 hours. and I can tell you a couple of clues, but I don't like to tell you without giving the rest of my story. So if I could hold that off till I tell the rest of my story, not steal my thunder. Okay? The first question was?
Interventions.
Interventions into a family should not be done by one person. It should be done by as many people that are part of that system as possible. Now, what are some of the interventions in particular addictions? In distancing? Just families that are basically dysfunctional?
I got a bigger family, the church. Interventions in the church that come in from outside.
Oh, okay. In the last 4 years, this was not my original job description, I had started working with congregations in conflict. And in the last 4 years, I've worked with 42 congregations, one seminary, and 3 schools. I can make a living just being a free floating consultant dealing with churches in conflict. Every congregation I've gone into, there are a couple of sessions. There are 4 to 6 antagonists, or 4 to 6 families that have been out of shape. Not 3, not 7. I guess 4 to 6 gives the oppositional group enough ego mass to oppose what's out there. I keep a record of what's going on in the families that are being antagonistic or oppositional and what. And there's always something going on. There's been a death of a child, death of a parent, divorce, marital problems, bankruptcy, pregnant teenager, son underachieving at school, you name it, or put them together. So I know something is going on in those families, and it's being played out on the institutional stage. Now, what systems thinkers say is that reactivity cannot continue unless there's counter-reactivity to it. That's the problem. As soon as folks get anxious, they get reactive, and then other people become anxious because these people are reactive and get reactive in return, and it becomes a spiral. So what I do is I go in to find out what's happening. Where is the virus? Where is the pathogen? And how is this all getting played out? Have I got a blackboard here? Is there something on here I could... I'd like to tell this story because this is a congregation that's in Church Grove. And has about 2,400 communicant members. It has a $2.5 million budget. It's now going in a $6.5 million expansion program. Has very fine staff. But I was called in, and this was a few years ago, when the staff was at 5. They now have 8. And when this is just a structure. Squares are males and circles are females. This is the senior pastor. This is the executive pastor. And under the executive pastor, there are 3 other associates in ministry. I was called in after this congregation had hired an expert from California and paid him $10,000 to work with the problem that they were experiencing. What he did was reshuffle the deck and assign new functions to folks. It was very important to do that, but he never dealt with the emotional system. I didn't get the $10,000, but I got $50 an hour. I just didn't charge enough, but I had to figure out what was going on in the system because I knew some of these people and these are pretty good functioning people. And what in the world was going on? Well, the executive pastor had anxiety. When I draw a line like that means anxiety with the senior pastor. And when that wasn't being resolved, he passed it on to the other staff members. Then he also went to the 3-person personnel committee and brought that anxiety over here. And then immediately the personnel committee came to the senior pastor. Well, the senior pastor was having hallucinations, lower back problems, and smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day. Why was he getting all the anxiety? Why was he being focused on? He's in the most responsible position. See, this is what we find out about systems. The people who are in the most responsible or vulnerable position in any system will get most of the anxiety. I worked in the Episcopal Seminary. They asked me to come in and deal with, it was a pretty conflicted situation. And I dealt with tenure and the bishop's role and the whole diocese and everything else. And I came in with 3 huge bags of grapefruit, oranges, and lemons. I know that academic people just love process. I'm wondering, how in the world am I going to get these folks to get into process? And they see me come in with these groceries. Well, what I said was, every grapefruit is 25 pounds of anxiety, every orange is 10 pounds, every lemon is 5 pounds. And I asked the dean to distribute. Who has the most anxiety system, who has the least? Well, who ends up with all of the grapefruits and oranges? The dean and the provost, the 2 most responsible, and the 4 untenured professors, the most And in most families, we know that the children who usually catch most of the anxiety and the reactivity of the system will be the oldest and the youngest, the most responsible and the most vulnerable. When I worked with this staff, which is now 8, just a couple weeks ago, there was anxiety in the staff. Who had it? The 2 staff members whose job most changed before, because 4 new staff members have come on, the most vulnerable. And again, the senior pastor, the most responsible. So in any system, if you're in the most responsible and vulnerable position, you catch all the anxiety. Now, if you are in both positions, if you are both responsible, and at some time you're hurting or you're grieving, watch out. Because you're going to catch people's anxiety. So when you're in both positions, it makes it worse. All right, but why was all of this going on? I finally found out when I heard 2 comments. One was, the senior pastor told me that this man's wife had come to him and said, I want to be appointed to the nominating committee because all of the good lay leaders get on your boards and my husband doesn't get them. And I also think you should have my husband preach, he should preach more. Well, I'm thinking, what is she doing in her husband's business? Then he told me that he and his wife share everything. There are no secrets between them. Well, fusion. Okay, what happened is, he got triangled between his wife and his wife's unhappiness. And a triangle is whenever something cannot get settled in a relationship, it gets shifted over to another person. For instance, God confronts Adam. Adam gets anxious, and so he shifts it, right? It's now between God and Eve. So the relationship is there. Or, you know, a nice one, just a normal kinds of thing. Mother has a terrible time with Johnny. And she says, Johnny, just you wait till Daddy gets home tonight because he's going to take care of it. Now it's between Daddy and Johnny. This is called triangulation. Or another example would be, why can't you be like other wives? Well, that's great. Now the problem's between you and other wives, and I'm on the outside position. Or, do you think God would like what you're doing? Well, that's wonderful. Now the problem's between you and God, and I'm in the outside position. See? Well, what she was doing is, she couldn't handle her own unhappiness. And there were some family reasons for that. She never wanted him to be a pastor. Her father's a high-paid professional, and her 2 brothers are. And here's her husband in second place, as she saw it. All right, so he carried her virus into the whole system and got all these triangles going on. I wrote a report, gave it to the personnel committee. Well, in about a week later, he is killed tragically. Okay. Now, the virus is still out here, but the carrier is not there, correct? How is that virus going to get in the system? Well, first of all, she said, she wanted a copy of my report. And they called, can she have a copy of your report? I said, well, my contract's with you. I said, if you want to give it to her, that's your choice. But also, I knew her father was a lawyer, and she had 2 brothers who were a lawyer, and I was hoping it wouldn't be their choice. But I said, I really would prefer that it not be given, because she said, he, the senior pastor, has seen the report and she hasn't, and he had an advantage. And I said, well, what's the competition?
Oh, geez.
Well, she then tried to use her grieving as a way to get the report and said, I cannot finish my grieving process if I don't get the report. So getting highly manipulative here. Well, in the meantime, these three people meet in the airport and said, what are we going to do? I taught him systems in an hour and went over the whole thing as I could see it. And I said, somebody is going to have to put boundaries around here because she cannot. And it has to be the leadership. One man said, well, I'll do it. And I said, no, you're the one who shouldn't do it because he's, you know, he's ready to give it to her. I want somebody to go in and help set the boundaries. And they did, because there were a lot of loose ends that they had to take care of at this particular point. And I also told her, if she kept leaking all of this discontent into the congregation, they would ask her to leave. And if she needed help in her grieving, they would take care of it. So when you get a chance to look at what goes on in the emotional system, how people function, you get a better view of what's happening. See, the theory that Ed Friedman has produced is differences do not cause difference. So all the content issues are not the issues. What creates the difference is the emotionality that is fed into the differences.
Say that last sentence again.
It's the emotionality that creates the force that creates the difference.
So in a situation where you can see some things developing or they have been developing for years and your constitution, as almost everyone's does, uses Matthew 18 as a guideline for this, how do you use that constructively and then destructively to do that? If everyone is as ignorant as everyone else in this, in how to deal with people.
In terms of what's actually going on and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, one thing is you could hire somebody from the outside to help you take a look at it. Because the folks that are involved in it are...
But most of us are in poor congregations.
Poor congregations. Well, by some of my news items. I just have to think. In June, I'll have a book out by the Albin Institute called How Your Church Family Works. But I really feel that this could be helpful. I'm writing it on a level so that, and with a lot of illustrations, so that people can use this to get this kind of information. But if you get involved in a reactivity and the folks are getting reactive, there's little chance that it's going to have a better resolution because you just all charged up. You're into each other.
Yeah, and I can understand not engaging it to not give it fuel, but at some point it seems like so often you have to try to put a stop somewhere, and it ends up negatively asking someone to leave, or the pastor and family have to leave because they can't deal with it anymore.
That usually happens when the situation gets so polarized, which is an emotional process, by the way. Polarization is an emotional process. That folks just, something like that has to happen.
Which is in and of itself an intervention of sorts, I guess.
In a way it is, correct. Another hand back. Yes.
Okay. New subject. What? Do you know why recovering alcoholics like to go to AA and don't like to go to church?
Well, what I've heard from them is that they get more acceptance, people understand them, they build up relationships with others. That's what I've heard from them. I couldn't answer it any other way. There's more sense of acceptance, community.
Have you ever...
And if you read Buechner's book again, I mean, he's really talking about when he went to this support group and all, that was... He really felt he got there what he should have gotten at the church, and the church was too dysfunctional to give it to him.
How about the role of guilt in that? Have you ever heard from anyone that our Lutheran liturgy emphasizes guilt too much?
No, I haven't heard that. Then when they come to church, the guilt
of
the...
Well, you start off primarily with a system of guilt, and then you go to grace later. But at some point in people's lives, they want to hear grace first.
That could be. I haven't heard that. John?
Well, I think what you were saying this afternoon, in your outlining, you know, of those points that you began with, probably has a lot to do with that question about, you know, the imaging, the mirroring. That's what we look for in community. And if those ingredients are there, in a church, then people will be there in the church, and that's what I think a lot of people find in recovery groups.
So you get a lot of good feedback and mirroring and so forth.
You get mirroring, you get acceptance, and all of those ingredients that it takes to make a whole person. So,
well, it's an AA meeting. I think people find that they can be honest and open. And I think that if we did that in some of our churches, that you might be thrown out the door. To admit that you're a sinner and to admit the things that you have done wrong and the mistakes that you have made, I'm not sure would always be accepted in our churches.
Well, why is that? According to,
I'm Methodist.
Churches are the same, though. The incredible mediocrity of what our Christian worship has become. The family gathers, smaller church. The family gathers there. Sometimes they even know each other. You know, they've grown up 40, 50 years with each other. But an absolute refusal to deal honestly with each other or to bring up anything of any importance. And when a family crisis happens, suddenly the family's not there for a couple of weeks. The very time they should come to worship to draw strength and renewal and hope. At the time they disconnect.
Well, I don't know how much permission we give people to be self-revealing. In a way, I hate to see that private confession has passed by the board, because I think that's a good place for folks to do some self-disclosing in a private setting. Well, why do people go to therapy? Why do they go to groups? You know, clergy said, I'd never say this to another clergy. I don't trust them. Or I can't tell so-and-so, or I can't go, you know, nobody in my family would understand. Evidently, the church is not seen as a safe place, as a place where I can be who I want to be. And that may be part of the dysfunctioning of the church, which says you have to be a false self to be here. And I remember a phrase by Norman Lear who said, you know, being a self is such a great thing because it doesn't seem to be what anybody wants.
As you deal with troubled pastors in your ministry, could you give us some specific examples of distancing pastors and the troubles they get into, as well as those who are fusioning type pastors and the kinds of difficulties that they face in their ministries?
Okay. The distancing pastor will often be seen as cold, standoffish, unapproachable. And people come to the church more for affection than for direction. And that pastor often gets in difficulty. But now in a larger parish, a pastor could be more emotionally distant and perhaps get away with it more than another place, because they need someone to do the direction rather than the affection. You get other lay associates or assistants to do that ministry. Just simply losing contact with where the people are. That person too, who is an emotional distance, can get into problems because old narcissistic tendencies can be aroused. Where I really don't connect to people, I use people for them to mirror back to me my grandiosity, but I'm not emotionally close to them. I had a case, for instance, where a pastor killed his wife, a Lutheran pastor. And I was called into this dual parish in West Texas to deal with the congregation. And a man killed his wife 1 week after he was out of seminary and was ordained. The people in the congregation said, well, it's like we knew this man all our life. I mean, he was a good narcissist. A lot of narcissists are charming, self-sufficient, enthusiastic, you know, they can charm the socks off you, and other things. but you see, that emotional distance, you know, he really hides his needs and his feelings, and he just projects on me. And what he wants back is other folks to project back his grandiosity. When you get a highly dependent congregation, they'll do that for him greatly. Because they need somebody who? To adulate and idealize. I had three congregations in Dallas, 11,000 members, 6,000 and 5,000. Two were Baptist, one was a community Christian fellowship, Four Square, something or other. Anyway. But I don't deal with non-Lutherans, but they heard that I was an expert in clergy affairs. dealing with clergy affairs. And in every case, there was a narcissist. Well, one pastor raped 5 people, and the other two had multiple affairs. And, you know, had very strong narcissistic tendencies. Just simply used people to feed back to what they wanted and so forth. So that's a strong tendency when you're over here in emotional distance to get in touch with your own narcissism, your own sense of glory and so forth. Over here is a lot of neurotic glory. You know, I get attention for saving you, lifting you up, taking care of all of your needs. This is a pastor who's going to build a lot of dependency on him or her. And you don't help people grow and mature. That's one of the problems. In some cases, you may have people who are immature, and they have to borrow your hope. But these people burn out a lot. And they also give away their sense of power to other people. And so when other people start saying, "You're wonderful, Pastor," where is that pastor's identity then? If it's all wrapped in what they say and they're no longer saying it, there's a lot of emptiness because you've allowed them to define who you are rather than you defining yourself to them. So I see a lot of folks who get into this dependent codependency burning out. I like to use the phrase from St. Paul. We are instructed to present our bodies as a living sacrifice unto the Lord, not as a burnt offering. And it's amazing, you know, most of us are obsessive compulsive. And the congregations reward us for our dysfunction.
What are your recommendations in avoiding that problem?
Obsessive compulsiveness? Well, recognize it yourself if you have it. And get out of denial. B, set better boundaries. I will do this, I will not do this, take days off, take vacation time, that type of thing. C, find someone who can be in your support group, gives you some good hearing and feedback as to what you're doing. And also remember that burnout's idolatry. The idolatry of your job or your own importance or the both. You have limits. I mean, that's what being separate and self-defining means. You're going to talk about your limits as to what you can do, you can't do, who you are, who you aren't.
I have a question. If you take the Lutheran Church as a whole and look at it as a family system, earlier today you talked about mirroring, and in the nuclear family you talked about the mother mirroring the child and adults mirroring each other. And I think there's some mirroring that goes on between us as people with God. And my question has to do with, if the way, the language that we use to talk about God is Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Heavenly Father, where does that leave me as a woman? Where am I mirrored? And how do I fit in the family then?
Interesting, because today I switched from mother and mirroring and I started talking about Heavenly Father. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of good maternal imagery for God in the scriptures.
Mm-hmm. But that isn't the prescribed language that
it's
we're told.
It's not the prescribed language, correct.
The bishops not too long ago said that you have to use Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in order to do baptisms. And my question is, doesn't it take if you use other language? And again, where does that leave me as a woman?
Oh, gee, where's Paul Broughton when I need him?
Yeah.
Or Justin, yeah. I'm not prepared to answer that for you in terms of how to answer that. Mm-hmm. You know, what formula is correct, and I haven't even read the literature on that. But it's a real question, and I'm not trying to dodge it. I don't know how to answer that.
But I'm wondering, in terms of a family, how does a person deal with that? In terms of a family system, being more or less told,
Am I right? Is the real critical image that a woman needs is a father, and that a man needs is a mother?
The most critical image at a particular period of time. Yeah. And that's mostly at pre-adolescence and early adolescence. But I don't know if that would be true just generally at all developmental periods. Now, you say the whole Lutheran Church. Would it be helpful to females in the church if we baptize in the name of the Mother and the Son and the Spirit rather than the Father? Or we just did Creator, what is it, Creator, Redeemer, and Sanctifier?
Or if there was just some balance there, some equity of images that we get. It's just very hard for me as a woman. In my private worship, I can use any language I want, but to be told that when you worship in public, you must use Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, for me, that makes me feel not part of the family. I feel like my being is not then reflected in God, and I'm not reflected in God. That I have no part. And I think that's really, I don't think that's healthy for
your question is, what is our language mirroring back to you as to who you are as a person created in the image of God?
Well, and how does the family system handle that when there are people not feeling like they fit into the family? I'm feeling like my family of the Lutheran Church is telling me, you don't fit in. So what am I to do, and what are other women or other men who feel to do about this?
Well, I'm going to give you an answer that Dr. Friedman mentioned one time. You may like it, you may not like it. In systems, we look at how people function, not necessarily how they're identified, mm-hmm. not the nomenclature. And he really believes that a lot of feminists who become militant have a lot of unfinished business with family of origin and are playing it out with the world. And he would say the same thing would be true of a person like Hitler, who was the child of an illegitimate Jew, and the father literally just beat the child, was very abusive to the child, and Hitler played that out with the world. That's how a family systems person would look at it, in terms of where does this stuff come out of family of origin. It would not deal with nomenclature. Talk about functioning position. And I think it's proper for women to say, hey, our role in the church, our functioning position has been minor, has been subordinate. And you're forcing the church to take a look at them. And that's significant. Because you've often been in the most vulnerable position, and you've often been scapegoated. I mean, I'm just horrified by some of these clergy that I hear that they say to their wives, if you want to have a Christian marriage, you have to do what I tell you. Which really means is, when I want sex, you better give it to me. That's manipulative. That's not a Christian man. I mean, some of that stuff that hangs around, I really gets to me. I don't know if I'm answering your question. I don't know how to answer that.
I have a question that's a little bit in a different direction.
Okay.
Back to the intervention in the congregation.
Yes.
And it seems to me that this concept, the family system approach, requires more than one person knowing how it works and being, you know, like within a congregational setting. And do you have some thoughts about that? I mean, if it were going to be used in a congregational setting, is it all the key leaders get trained in this, or is it just the pastor and the staff, or the whole congregation? I mean, how is it a technique or a way of thinking that you begin to teach the whole community?
Yeah, and I'm glad you made that correction, because family systems deals more with a way of thinking, of perception, of seeing what's going on, rather than technique. My experience is that the key is the leadership. And my last presentation will be about leadership and how leadership brings calm to the whole field. And that leadership would include call staff, elected people, people of influence. That's not to say that other people in the congregation couldn't benefit from knowing something about family systems.
So that leadership learns how to disconnect the anxiety.
To get out of that reactivity to the reactivity, correct. Or also to be able to set boundaries. Or to say, look, we have a rubric when we have conflict. And we go back to the scriptures, and as we personalize it, we go one-on-one. Whether it's Matthew or the church at Corinth or the council in Jerusalem, the rubric is one-on-one. And they will also disallow secrecy. We know that all dysfunctional families have secrets. And secrecy is an anxious response to anxiety. And so I push people to announce the conflict that's going on in the church and not keep it secret.
To the whole body.
Yeah, a lot of people say, well, don't tell the congregation. That's like, well, don't tell the children. You know, treats them like very dependent people. I say, announce it. We've got an issue, we're going to try our best to deal with this, and this is what steps we're going to take, and so forth and so on.
The Friedman book was really helpful to me as a clergy wife. One chapter gave some real nuts and bolts examples of how clergy could actually work to diffuse just by virtue of the fact that they are not going to remain in that same homeostasis status quo. And so the system can't stay the same.
It's also a way to learn how to define yourself to others. And when I go in to work with these congregations, the number one thing I have to do is not be anxious and not be over-serious. In fact, I had a client just 2 weeks ago in Houston. We're on the 25th floor, and his wife's having affairs and is leaving him, the pastor. And he says, I'm very suicidal. I don't like being here on the 25th floor. And I said, well, please don't do anything until after the session. And just went on. Well, what I learned was, when you're serious, you're reactive. And the more serious I'm going to be about all this, what's it going to do to my client? Get him more reactive. I take it seriously, but I'm not serious. So that's why being playful can be very helpful. Almost a little passive-aggressive. Oh, we Lutherans love that. But knowing that you're being passive-aggressive in doing it, yeah. Playfulness.
Peter, I have a question about what Elizabeth Bettenhausen said. I believe she said in her early part of her presentation about the number of women clergy going to the seminary who come from dysfunctional homes, especially homes where there's been incest or some kind of abuse from a father or uncle or other male family member. And I'm wondering, first of all, what that says about the need of women like that going into the ministry, and secondly, if there is a corresponding set of data that says that men come from similar backgrounds, whole family structures.
That's an interesting question. I would say that I have seen the examples of what she's talking about. I've also seen many male clergy whose spouses have come out of abusive families. I would say the graduates of the last 10 years, 7 out of 10 spouses have come out of that situation that I've seen. Men usually, male clergy have been abused more emotionally and verbally. Because the number one feature I find in male Lutheran clergy is a father who is emotionally distant or absent. Or who never told his son what he did well, but always told him what he did wrong. Or expected his son to be perfect. Do it right or don't do it at all. So there are different kinds of abuse. The means don't mean anything. Abuse still is destructive to somebody. What this means for ministry, if people are able to process that and work through it, it could be very positive to make people more sensitive to the issue. If not worked through, it'll be played out with people in the parish or somewhere.
The basically what we're saying is that we're having more and more reactive or dysfunctional people going to the seminary and then coming out of the seminary, going into dysfunctional congregations. And my question is, where do we stop it? I just came out of 2 years at the seminary, and I'm an intern, and very, very dysfunctional nature, seminary, and people there. And seminary wants to operate as an academic institution. And it does not have the time or the means to be the counseling center. And I want to know where the process of help comes. Or where do we work with this? Do we wait until a pastor sexually abuses his parishioners? Until we say that there's a problem? Or do we start acknowledging in the seminary that we better start the process early and work with it?
Well, the preferable part is to start when you hear it and you see it and it's there at the seminary. I have five seminary students right now as clients because there's only 30 students in the extension in Austin. But there, the seminary is very sensitive and will give financial support to the individual. So there is at least a small model of that happening. Congregation is a little more difficult matter because they've been around for a while and their pattern's gotten formed. But they too need therapy in many cases.
And then what happens once, let's say, the pastor gets therapy and the pastor is trying not to be reactive and not dysfunctional, and you have the dysfunctional system of the congregation, all of a sudden very resentful because they don't have their player anymore. They don't have their reactive person in the parish, that pastor role, reactive to them.
Oh, they'll find somebody else, but... But this is what's important. You can be as self-defining as you can be and do it well, but you cannot keep people confusing with you. And you cannot keep people from emotionally distancing them. That may be where you use the story, you need to shake off the dust of your feet and move on to the next town. And that could be appropriate. Because when you put oil and water together, it doesn't mix, and that may be the situation that's there. But also remember this, if someone else is an antagonist, if they're passive-aggressive, if they're obsessive-compulsive, they're pathological liars, it's only significant if it affects how you function.
Meaning?
If there are alligators in the church, it's only significant in terms of how it affects your functioning. What you have to focus on is your own self and who I'm going to be and how I'm going to function and deal with your own anxiety. Because our initial thrust is to try to change the other people. And we focus on how they're functioning. And the only way I change the system is by changing how I function. So I will now do marital therapy with only one person. Because I know if that person functions differently in the marriage, what's going to happen in the marriage? It's going to change. So I usually say to the male spouse, who usually doesn't come, you want to be part of the change, or you want to have it dropped on you all of a sudden, explode in your face? Because, you know, if she's coming to therapy, and she's here at least 10, 12 sessions, and she's got enough pain, and she's making an effort to change on it, it's going to change. I know, you know, you're going to sabotage it at home, but she'll probably make the change.
Another comment, in my just thinking about this and reading some of the Friedman's stuff, I was impressed with the lack of judgment that seems to be a part of the thinking, in that that there's no right or wrong, good or bad about this. It's a question of being effective and a question of being able to look at what the patterns are and to do some effective decision-making about what your part of that is.
It gets into a non-blame situation, because when you get blame and both sides are blaming, you get into immaturity. And the more you get into immaturity, you've got all kinds of other factors that are going to limit any hope to make repairs.